Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Sundays with the Modern. To those of you unfamiliar with the program, on the first Sunday of each month, when admission is waived, we invite prominent local artists, art historians, architects, and others to give us their thoughts on works on view. Today we welcome Philip Van Curen to discuss the work of Lucian Freud. Mr. Van Curen is currently a professor of art at Southern Methodist University. He is also the director emeritus, and before that, the longtime director of SMU's Pollock Gallery. A Dallas native and, importantly, a longtime friend of the Fort Worth Modern. He holds a BFA and an MFA in studio art from SMU and also participated in the prestigious Whitney Museum of American Art Independent Study Program. Philip Van Curen interprets the word artist in its broadest sense. In his long career, his work has crossed media and disciplines. He is variously painter, sculptor, photographer, gardener, curator, printmaker, and poet. Philip Van Curen.
Thank you, Michael. It's always odd, those of you that have had the opportunity to hear somebody talk about you, it's always kind of like, is that me? But I did want to say a few words before I talk about the show. How happy I am to be here, how fond I am of the Fort Worth Modern, going all the way back to my first years as an artist in 1971, 72. Used to be a very big deal to come to Fort Worth to go to all the museums over here. Very big part of my earliest years as an artist were basically self-taught before I started going to school, taking courses, and coming to these museums over here. I remember coming to the Kimball when it opened, and coming to all these museums over here is a big part not only of my life, but as I was telling Michael earlier, I don't think you can find an artist in Dallas that wouldn't tell you, if they were telling you the truth, that they much prefer these museums over here and the history of what they've seen here, perhaps to what they've seen in Dallas, although I don't want to demean Dallas, but this is a very special place with all these museums on this one street, a spectacular place. I was actually lucky enough as a young artist to be in a couple of shows at the Fort Worth Modern at the old location, and I was always very excited to come over and to see the work in such a great place. First of all, I'd like to thank all of you for standing here and listening to this talk. When I was contacted by the Fort Worth Modern some months ago, it seems like forever ago, about would I do this, I was, without even thinking, I said yes, and then later I thought, do I really want to do this? And as time has gone by, I'm more and more pleased to do it. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about Freud again. And I've seen several things in recent years that sort of color my thinking about Freud in a way that had not been there, I would say, 20, 30, even 40 years ago when I first began being an artist. I will say when I first began to study art, Freud was not someone that I even knew about. This is in the early 70s. And I'm at a university, and if Freud was mentioned or I ever saw a work of Freud's, I cannot remember it. My main confrontation with Freud's work happened in New York City. I've been lucky enough the last 20 years to teach a course in New York for SMU, where I take a group of students, usually 25 to 30 students, to New York for 2 weeks in January, to go to museums, galleries, artist visits, whatever we can work in, concerts, readings, you name it. So it's a great group of people. I'm very lucky to do that. In 93, 94, the Metropolitan Museum of Art did a huge Freud retrospective. I don't know, I'm guessing some of you in this room saw it. For me, it was, I have to say, for the students, it was one of the things that was just astonishing. And we were very happy to have been there at that time. I spent a lot of time in that show. Went back several times to the Met at night looking. And not only, one of the good things about New York is whenever there's a major exhibition at one of the major museums, there's usually a lot of spin-off exhibitions at galleries, other places. And I was lucky enough that year my recollection of the show at the Met is that it did not contain prints. It may have, I don't remember them, but there was an excellent Freud print show at a very small gallery called Steibel Modern, run by a woman named Penelope Steibel. And they maybe only had six, maybe seven etchings in there, and it was a very small space, but it was just astonishing. It basically just kind of stopped me in my tracks for various reasons, and that's what led to my wanting to organize an exhibition of prints, and that exhibition was held in 1996. This is the catalog to that exhibition. I do want to mention Martin Posner, who's standing right here, who was one of the lenders to that show. And the whole show, actually Marlboro Lint Works, we had all these etchings. And at the time, it was the largest exhibition of Freud etchings in a not-for-profit university gallery. I was able to put this show together. I mean, you really don't have a budget. Never did, never will. Because of lenders. Penelope lent me every single one of her etchings, went to Matthew Marks, they lent me everything they had, Marlboro lent me everything they had, and Martin lent me everything he had. So we had a big show, and it was just an amazing show. This, I just want to say that this catalog is still available. If you happen to want one, all you have to do is contact the Pollock Gallery at SMU, and we'll get you one. I'm actually going to read a little bit out of here. I know I actually like being read to. Some people don't like it. But I'm very fond of, as a poet especially, I read a lot, write a lot to people. But so I'm going to read a few things out here. But the one thing I want to do, let's go ahead and walk into this gallery right here. And I'll start with a few things. I'm guessing that you've seen the show and you're familiar with the work in here. Is this chronological? It seemed like it was. Roughly. Yeah. So one thing in this room, and this is where I came into the show when I first walked in, the thing that I was most kind of surprised at, one of the things I really want to talk about with this show is really what I think now colors my thinking about Freud and colors my thinking. I'm actually going to talk about things that are not in this room. And by doing that, I'm talking about things that are in this room, if that makes any sense to you at all. There was several exhibitions in New York that when I walked into this room, I was just stunned at kind of a moment of illumination. I don't know, maybe some of you saw the Renaissance portrait show at the Met, which was there this last time I was teaching the class in January. And an astonishing show that I'm familiar with from my art history and from my own reading and going to museums for so long. That was an astonishing show in the way that it was laid out. And it basically began, it's the 15th century in Italy, mostly. Some European, some north of the Alps, much south of the Alps. It showed a huge moment in the world of art that this is tied to. And I can't look at this work and think about this work anymore, and certainly cannot talk about this work anymore without thinking about what I saw in those galleries. Essentially, and I just want to read a few things that I jotted down because I don't want to miss some of these names. And then I'll go back and kind of explain it a bit more. This is portraiture, to be sure. And there was a first great age of portraiture, which was taking place in Europe, north and south of the Alps in the 15th century, with some of these artists, but other ones as well. These you're probably very familiar with: Donatello, Botticelli, Mantegna, Bellini, Domicina, and that's a good group. But what's happening in that show when you first walked in is you saw a kind of portraiture that was very stagnant. It was basically profile portraiture off of a coin, say. We still see it on our coins. That was one of the prevalent ways of showing portraiture in the early 15th century. They were recognizable likenesses, but not terribly interesting. When you go back and look at them, and even earlier, we're all familiar with all the earlier work in Europe, mostly religious oriented or nobility, in which these people were the power brokers of that world, and they wanted images which projected that. The church wanted it, the nobility wanted it, and that's what artists did. Well, things begin to radically change, and Freud comes right out of that. I mean, he comes out of the deepest feelings of that, I would say. What happens is that expressions of personality, of the inner world, begin to just emerge. I mean, they're just like an egg hatching and just coming out, and you can see it in those galleries. In the beginning, they may still be important people, but you're seeing them in a completely different way. The profile, the standard profile that you see in coins, that static way of seeing a body just goes away. And its place is a transcendental timelessness from about 1450 on. And that's what we're seeing here. I'm convinced that's what we're seeing in this Freud show. Subjects begin to look back at you. They don't just look through you. They begin to look like physical human beings with a life and a death and a sense of mortality. And that's exactly what's going on here. That's over 500 years ago. And I'll come back to it later, because when I talk about the etchings, the other thing I can't forget when I come in here is Rembrandt. I mean, Rembrandt is just so much in this world. Now, I have no idea. I haven't read the didactic labels. I've read a few books on Freud, but I wouldn't say I've read a lot of what people think. I don't know what he thought about Rembrandt. Someone may have written a whole book about something that he said about Rembrandt. I don't know what he thought about these Italian artists and the northern artists like Hans Memling. I don't know what he thought about those people. But those people are Hans Memling. About this time period in the 15th century, there was also a Hans Memling show at the Frick in New York several years back. And there are paintings in this room that look like they were painted by Hans Memling. It's just astonishing. You know, that Northern European, I would call that light that's there, that kind of starkness of the vision. The American poet Robert Haas said something once. He said that images haunt. And I've always liked that phrase, that images haunt. They all haunt. All these images haunt. They haunt me when I stand in front of them. There's a haunting sense to them. But they're especially haunting in here in places. The painting of the young woman holding the rose over there, the painting of the boy, the painting of the woman here, those are just astonishing paintings to me because of, you know, they're some of his earliest work. And he's growing out of a tradition. But he's growing out of a tradition that's 500 years before him, which I find just astonishing. There's I want to really digress here. I mentioned an artist who was in that show at the Met, Antoninello da Messina. This is not an artist that I'd ever heard of. And if I ever saw a da Messina, I don't remember it. And so happens at the Met in 2006, they had a room full of them. And they had borrowed them from Palermo. They'd come over from Italy. I think something was happening to that space in Italy and they needed to get these works. I'm going to hold this card up to you, and I know that you can't really tell much about it, but I bought this card there of a painting that was in that room. And this is, I think, one of the most radical paintings of its time ever done. And I'm going to explain that to you a little bit. And I think that this is, again, This is that Renaissance portrait, that huge change that was happening, that has given birth to a person like this, whether he knows it or not. And I'm sure that he did. The Virgin Annunciate. I mean, we've all seen Annunciations. The ones prior to this usually are triptychs. There's a dove coming in through the window. There's the Visitation. We've seen those. They're very static. They're very spiritual, and that's what they're meant to be. This is just a girl. This is just an Italian girl. And the way that this thing is painted, there's no messenger flying in the window. There's no dove coming in the window anymore. There's no need for it. That world is changing. And the best way I can convey this to you is I want to read you a poem that I wrote about this painting. I've tended over the years to start writing, this is a book of my poems, writing a lot of poems about paintings. And I wrote one about this that I think most clearly sort of signifies what's going on with that painting and why that painting relates to the things that are in this room. I think the paintings in this room are looking at us just like this, that they're trying to communicate to us just like this. Not in some spiritual, powerful, governmental sense, but just as one human being to another about the deepest things in the world, which is still a religious painting. I'm sure Damasceno was a very, you know, very deeply entwined in his religion. He's not a heretic. So this is the little poem I wrote after seeing this painting at the Metropolitan Museum. And it's entitled Messenger for Antonello da Messina. I did not know then what I know now, that at the end of the row of galleries there would be this glowing image in heavenly blue, the color of which I have never seen in all my years of looking, and that her eyes would be so slightly cast down and have such humility that my heart would break at the sight of her, and her left hand would be so tenderly holding together the two sides of her luminous shawl, and that all this would make me linger so long in the room and return again and again for many days to come, or that her slight, sad smile would be so impossible to forget, and her reluctant acceptance of her fate so brave and so unlikely for the child she still was, or that her painter creator could make me, if just for a moment, the angel bearing the message, that she, with her barely uplifted right hand, would try so vainly, if just for a second, to delay. This is a radical thing. You're the messenger. The painting is completed by you, not some kind of interior in that painting, which you know, all those hundreds of years before, those paintings were kind of separate from the person. He makes you part of the deal, and that's the birth of modernism, in my opinion. Everything comes from moments like that. You are now important. You are the viewer. You complete the story. And I think that happens in here. And I think it very much happens in here. I'd like to talk about a few individual works in here. You know, you've seen the show and you know what's here. It's a huge amount of work. You wouldn't want to hear me talk about all this stuff anyway, and we'd be here for a long time. But there's a few works that I really want to look at real quick before we, and then we'll just move through here. And then, because I've done so much with the etchings, when we get down there and being more specific about the etchings, I really don't feel there's much difference in talking about a painting and talking about an etching and talking about that bench to me. You look at things and you spend a lot of time with them, and you just, you know, you look and you start finally to see. Robert Hughes, the art critic that I really admire, and Hughes was a friend of Freud's, and there's actually a few little phrases in here that came from Hughes. But Hughes said a very interesting thing that I tell my students. He talks about learning how to see, and he says that learning how to see is rather difficult, and he says that you know that you're beginning to see when you're no longer bored by the absence of the spectacular. And I think that's an astonishing thing, because we live in an age where everything has to be an explosion of some kind, verbal, musical, visual, and that the smaller things, the smaller pleasures, the interior world, is a little bit harder to see because we simply do not spend the time. There is nothing. These are spectacular and not spectacular in a completely different way. These are very humble paintings in here by, I think, an exceedingly humble man. Let me just talk about a few here, and then we'll walk over there. I'm going to talk about these two paintings right here. I'm rather pleased that the Fort Worth Modern doesn't have these huge didactic labels that are like this big, trying to explain everything in the world to you. One of the things I always tell my students in New York is, read the didactic, read the book, listen to the earphones, but not before you've just gone through there on your own and spent time with things, and really just, you know, look at them like you're a child and you've never seen anything in your life before, and have some wonder in your mind and just look at things. These two right here, if you don't know the work of Hans Memling, and there's not a lot of it, I believe in the Frick show was in the bottom layer of the museum, and the line, it's the first time I've ever stood in a line in New York to look at work, and I was with my wife, and it was brittle cold, maybe 5 degrees. We stood outside in a line to get in the Frick. We stood outside for an hour. Once we got inside, it was probably another hour and a half to see this show. But I would do it again in a minute. These are so much like that northern work that's being done in Europe, 15th century. And one reason they're like that is this beautiful kind of attention to detail. And also this face. The eyes are... I don't know if you can look at this without looking at the eyes. I can't. And the eyes are basically, as cliche as it is, they're the window into the soul. And so this person almost seems, to me, this person seems lost in thought. They're not... If this person were in the room with me, I would think they were somewhere else. And so they are somewhere else in this painting, to be sure. But the beautiful kind of attention to detail, this wonderful kind of soft light that's very much, it's the kind of light you get on a very cloudy day, very very much in the low countries. You see it a lot in the paintings up there. Huge attention to detail, all the little eyelashes, beautiful little bangs hanging down, this little hair thing here, which is really an interesting thing because this painting was done in 1947. When we get all the way down there and some of the etchings, you'll see what I call bristle. You'll see a kind of bristling along the edge, especially in the etchings. You see it often in many of the paintings. I don't think it's an accident that bristling is occurring here, and it's occurring in something 50 years later. It lends it a spikiness, a kind of an intense emotional sense that would be gone if this were all smoothed out. The painting down here, I always think of this as a boy. I called it a boy earlier. It's a girl, obviously. Here again, amazing attention to detail. The person's eyes, the actual retina in here, it looks like you're looking at a universe. It's just, it reminds me, once I met the painter Agnes Martin, and her eyes looked just like that. And you couldn't hardly look at her because you were just floating through her eyes into some vast other place. Again, beautiful grays, coloration of grays. There's a bit of a halo here, so a little bit of blue back in there. I have no idea what that was, but I'm guessing maybe that background might have been blue at one point. One thing to remember, and we actually see it pretty strongly down there, we can actually see an arm that got moved someplace else. He doesn't do that a lot. He doesn't leave you a trail of things moving. But anybody that paints will tell you that what you see is just the end product of who knows how many kinds of decisions and things went into it. Freud also, I mean, we see it all the way to the end. He loves to frame like this. You know, we see figures that are, we can see the whole figure, but this framing device is another way to cause a kind of intimacy. That person is pushed toward us, whether we want them to be pushed toward us or not. We see it over and over again in here. We see it in here. This, to me, is much different painting. This is 57, 58, 51. You can already see what's happening here with the texture of the face. This is beginning to be a face that we can recognize more way down the hallway. To me, it's a face that's the face that's underneath the skin. That's how I can best describe it when I look down here. So many of his figures down there look to me like they've just been skinned. If you've ever seen any kind of an animal with no skin, that's what they look like. And again, I think that that's just kind of reaching into a deeper vulnerability, making it may seem like a rather unintimate act to do a huge painting of a nude person. But I think by the way that he, I mean, again, I think you probably already know this, all these people are his friends. He doesn't paint people that he doesn't know. And so it's a small world. That's why we're seeing a lot of the same faces over and over again. Especially down there. I mean, it looks as if he just kind of paints the same 10 people for the rest of his life. I don't know how many of you have ever seen a photograph of Freud's studio. Have some of you seen that image? Well, it's a mess. I mean, and that doesn't even begin to describe it. Some of these paintings actually came out of there. It's just hard to believe. The studio looks like the painting. There is no, you know, for him, I think as an artist, he's an artist all the time. I mean, he's never not an artist. Just because he's working on a painting doesn't make him an artist. He's in that world, completely submerged in that world all the time. Let's look at one painting over here real quick. You can see that face that I was talking about, which is almost the first one. You can see what's happening to the way he's handling paint. And it's interesting because he's not yet doing much with the hair. The hair looks painted rather normally and also very, very fast. This looks like it's painted pretty fast to me. Where he starts to slow down a little bit, in paintings, this looks like a more difficult painting for him. But all this room, and then we get down, I think these are good images to carry us into the next room. I think especially this one. I was struck when I was looking in the other room how often he paints furniture and backgrounds. It's almost like he has an assistant. And he turns to the assistant and says, paint me this chair, because it's painted in such a different hand. In such a different speed. Because I think he wants that tension between what this is, which is a living being, and what this is, which is just a place. And he carries that all the way to the end, although at the very end, he begins to dissolve that distinction, I think. I've actually never seen this painting in person, and I think this is a really good one to look at right now because he starts to be very interested in very odd perspective, which was just not there at all. That's all very frontal. And now, I don't know where he is, where he's able to paint this. I don't know like he's got a mirror on the floor or something. You know, he's looking. A lot of the paintings are titled Reflection, and I think he must be looking down at a mirror. I don't know exactly how this all plays in. This looks very quickly painted, as if there's just not a lot of going back and forth on it. The faces up here look almost, I can almost feel the brush in my hand making that mark. I mean, there's just a variety of marks. When we get down to the end, It's hard to tell what he's doing. It reminds me a lot of, if you've seen any Monet water lily paintings up close, and you stand right next to them, you can't see anything. It just looks like about a half inch of paint that's just been, it's like looking at dirt. And then when you back up, you can see the lilies, and you can see the water and the reflections. I want to go ahead and read a couple of things out of here, even though I'm talking about etchings. I actually brought a card I carry of a Rembrandt etching that I like a lot. There's no other person that I can think of, again, this Northern European, that the birth of etching, of intaglio, etching is just one of four processes in intaglio printmaking. That also happened, with artists like Dürer, and you're probably familiar with Dürer's etching. Dürer is a painter. But this is also, this is Rembrandt, and this is 1659. This is much later than Memling in that those 1450 paintings that I was talking about. But still, here's a god. I mean, this is not the way gods were shown in the 12th century. This is a god lusting after a mortal. And so, again, this whole world of emotional feelings, all those kinds of tensions in an interior world are beginning to just grow almost out of proportion to anything that you think could have happened. But it all goes back to the 1450. There's a couple of little things I wanted to touch base with here, even though we're standing in front of a painting. And I want to... I wanted to share this little comment with you that Clement Greenberg said. Most of you probably know who Clement Greenberg was. Very instrumental in Jackson Pollock's world. He was a critic and very supportive of abstract expressionism. And at that time, this is something that Greenberg said, and this is how I started my essay. He said, the one thing you can't do in art anymore is make a portrait. I just wanted to share that with you because be careful what you say. Because I don't think there is anything that you can't do anymore. I think we now know that standing here in 2012. I'm going to wait and read some of this when we get down to the prints, actually. This is a little bit about portraiture and a few other things. Let's go down further deeper into these other larger paintings, if we might. I think this is I really like the way that the I'm guessing Michael Opping laid this exhibition out. You know, as a visitor to a museum, you come in and you look at things, and I know as a curator myself for 20 years. That the there's a lot of things about curating and running a gallery that aren't very pleasant, but one of the things that is pleasant is taking works of art and organizing them in a space and trying to make some deeper unity, deeper truth kind of evident. And I think that the way this show's laid out is just quite beautiful. I especially like this room with these three paintings facing these three paintings here. The paintings and then the two little ones down there's a beautiful little room. This room takes us into a more contemporary world, I think. And also these people all have their clothes on, which becomes a kind of a, I think a little bit about Rembrandt when I see that. You know, Rembrandt, the nudes that Rembrandt did, or etchings, I don't think he ever did. I mean, there could be some nudes in some paintings. But for Rembrandt, basically, this window he had to show this inner world was the face. That's how he was able to do it. There might be clothing. Those are usually the accoutrements of one's place in life, who you are. And those, again, are just more metaphors, more signals to communicate who this person really is. And in these cases, he often uses dogs because of the connection that people have with animals are often put in there. I also think he just likes dogs. He had dogs. Pluto, which is down here, all the etchings that have Pluto in it, I'm very fond of. But you'll see dogs showing up from time to time. This man is not just holding this dog. He's really holding it. I mean, he's got the dog. In fact, it looks like the dog kind of wants to get down or something. But the man is so kind of relaxed in the way that he's sitting here. And I would say with the head back, maybe a bit of an arrogant man, it's hard to say. But then we start seeing the face. We start seeing things happen in his face that did not happen over there. There's a bunch of junk in this paint. And at the end, we really see it. But for those of you that don't paint, and I don't think anybody paints in a studio quite like Freud, although maybe you do, that's happening because of the state of that studio. It's a mess. So he's got an awful lot of dried paint, bits of paint, palettes that aren't ever really clean, brushes maybe that aren't clean. He's got a lot of stuff around, rags that aren't clean. And so he's getting a lot of debris kind of getting in with the paint. Obviously he wants it, because if he didn't want it, he'd get rid of it. I think we can be sure of that. But what it does when he begins to let that happen, and it wasn't happening over there, maybe he just hadn't painted long enough to have a big mess. But we start getting a face that's even more kind of unsure to see, even harder to see, what is the face? Which part of this it really is who the person is? There's more of a, they're beginning to wear more of a mask in a way. But it's all we have. I mean, all we have to know this person. If you take the face away, we really have no way of knowing them. But this is still pretty inscrutable. Still pretty hard to look at and understand anything. This is one that I really enjoyed because of this over here. And again, these incredible hands that almost look like the feet of a chicken or something. I mean, this is very strong, incredible strong hand kind of pushing down here. Here we see again his funny kind of perspective. He's got more than one perspective going on here. If you took a photograph of a person sitting in a chair, you would not get this funny bend. There's no way you would get it. This head is kind of coming toward you, then the torso goes down, and then this comes up. We really see it later on, where he's almost looking straight down at the floor here, but then there's great perspective going back here. You can't really, that's not the way the world is. It just doesn't do that. But in a painting, of course, he can do anything he wants. I'm not sure what this is. It looks like a painter's cloth, kind of wadded up, stuck in there. It's just a great companion for this. You know, in Freud, I think that the metaphor, I think everything is there for a reason. And I think if it wasn't, he would just take it out. His affection for wood floors, which is evident, and for textures, for backgrounds, that could be painted, this whole background could be painted a lot flatter and more uniform. But this is where he gets a different kind of speed. There's a totally different speed in the way he's painting here, in the way the brush is working, than what we see up here. So we have two, well, we have more than, we have several worlds at work here, all in kind of the same moment. But the suit is painted a lot like the faces were in the other room. Very, like, you know, that wasn't that hard to do. This is one with an interesting perspective, because you can definitely see that he's sort of looking down here, but he's definitely not looking down here. So the whole it's like a scanner just took this figure and just made them occupy a greater space than they could normally. There's the hands again. The only part of this painting that are painted like the face and the hands are these torn and shredded ends of the chair, which is really quite beautiful. I mean, there's where the wear is. There's where the grief is, the love, the loss. You know, it's just an amazing... This is not an accident. I can't believe that it's an accident. This is an interesting one right here. This is a little bit of the Hans Memling world back here. But the placing of these two women in this room is getting into a world of some pretty deep psychological undercurrents. We haven't really seen this before. This is not just two women. This is two women that lived in a different world. I mean, radically different world. And they're both just staring off to nothing. They're not even aware of each other. It's interesting that this woman, who seems way too bad for this, too big for this little bed here, it reminds me of some of the paintings, again, going back to the Met. You'll see a figure walking down a road, and right next to them is a castle, and the castle, the figure is this big, and the castle's that big. There's this ability to change scale for just psychological reasons. This woman's like she's laying in a dog bed or something, tiny. So there's an uncomfortableness there, and the fact that she goes off into, you know, where's she coming from here? Where is that bed? I mean, is the bed going into another room? And the beautiful painting of this, I'm guessing it's felt, this fabric right here. This is a little bit like the painting we saw over there, that spikiness again, that Northern European spikiness. He finds different ways of doing it. These are just, you know, you could look at that forever. Here's this wood that he loves to paint. Here's this background, very plain. This is interesting along this wall here. Why is this so clean? What's happening here? This looks like a drop cloth, maybe. So then, you know, it's. I think many of these paintings, maybe most of them, maybe even all of them, are painted in his studio at different times during a long life. So it's hard to say exactly, you know, where this was done. I will say I don't think he's making anything up. I don't think he ever makes anything up. Let's start going back into this room where things get very interesting. Okay. This is, I can't really talk about the show without talking about this painting. I've already gone on longer than I should, but I'm going to keep talking a little bit, and you know, feel free to wander off. This is full-blown Lucian Freud. This is as good as he ever gets. This is a world that he arrives at, and he pretty much stays in until he dies. There's different sizes. Again, it's a self-portrait. He's nude. He's a man stripped bare, not only of his clothes, but of every pretense, maybe every hope he ever had, every dream he ever had. He understands that people die, people fail. He understands everything about life at this point, and he lets this painting tell us that. Again, I cannot get this figure to look at me. He almost looks at me. But he's looking inside. He's looking, eyes are pointing out, but he's looking inside. It really is a completely self-contained, this is just who I am, and I'm worn, and I'm ravaged. But I can still do this. This is the thing I can do. It was said of de Kooning, even when he, in his late years, when he had Alzheimer's, the one thing he never forgot how to do was to paint. They'd put him in the studio. He couldn't do anything else. And they would set out some stuff, and he'd start painting. I mean, that's the thing that he could not forget how to do. And I think that's the same case here. This is just a stunning painting. Again, background's pretty simple. No need for a background. This is the world right there. But he is in a place. There's a painting in here. This is the... This, again, is such a beautifully laid out room with large works and small works. It's a very intimate room. It's an intimate room for works that are exceedingly intimate. You don't need to back up from these paintings to kind of look at them. You know, what you really want to do is walk right up to them. This is the painting where he moved an arm, which really... stuck out to me because he usually manages to kind of hide that movement, and I found that very interesting. Just as an artist, also here is where we begin to see, boy, this paint is just what that is a Monet water lily painting in red and yellow. I mean, it's just scrumbled. It's like he's painting with dry pigment, and just this stuff is just being kind of pushed around. It's almost as if the body is in decay, as if we're seeing something that's just a... and again, he has individuals lying down, reclining, which is, a metaphor for mortality. I mean, that we don't die and stay standing. We die, we're down low. Sleep is a kind of death. And so here we have all these kinds of metaphors. Again, here's this younger person making a thing of beauty, bed, companion dog. Very interesting background here. Very unlike the backgrounds we're seeing before. Even this one, which we're used to seeing before, it's got so many bits of stuff in it. Dirt, just the chaos of the studio. This background is quite unusual. I have no idea why that background's doing that. And if that wall looked like that, it's an amazing wall. Because here's another wall that could be like it with much more order to it, rectangles and so forth. This is one of his favorite models, a person that was a friend of his. Again, that looks like a drop cloth all wadded up in the corner. I wanted to go around the corner here real quick. I think this is a lovely little painting right here called Esther. I spent a lot of time looking at this little painting. This has a little bit of the early sensibility in that it looks fairly quickly painted, with not a lot of, there's just not a lot of paint on this painting. Again, just focusing right on the head. The head is still, as a metaphor, that's where we are. That's us. The whole idea that one is beheaded and that's that's the end of everything. I mean, that's where we are. We have a heart, but basically the head is the... I think the head is still very, very important to Freud. And it has been from the very beginning. Let's go ahead and look at some of these etchings real quick. You know, the little things that are on the wall here, these little quotes that Freud made, it's always interesting to me to, when museums do this, to read these things and kind of think about them. I'm not sure I agree with this one. I don't know if that's really what he means to say or not, but it's interesting to read it and kind of have my own thoughts on it. Let's talk about these etchings a little bit. I'm going to go ahead and read a little excerpt from this book. I'm going to leave out most of this, but like I said, this book's available. It's a nice little book. If you want one, you know, we could get you one. So I think this is important to mention this before we go into that other room. This is just some thinking that I had before, and it's just easy for me to read you a little piece of it. What some critics have interpreted as isolation, boredom, and alienation in the faces of Freud's models is more likely the signs of fatigue that come with posing hour after hour. Posing, as anyone who has spent time modeling or working with model knows, is arduous work. Indeed, many of the reclining figure compositions may come about to provide subjects with a pose that is easier to hold for long periods. Freud offers that he wants his sitters, quote, lying in positions that come naturally to them, essentially being themselves. I want my models to look as unset up as possible. Avoiding professional models, Freud explains, I paint only people who are close to me. Reverent observation, tenderness, objective delicacy all come together to create haunting images. For Freud never considers his drawing subjects to be naked. Instead, he suggests, their skin has become another form of clothing. Oh, sorry. I'm trying not to sneeze into this microphone. Freud turns the same remorseless, fierce intensity that he displays toward his models, toward his son, in this one painting that I had, and the 1996 etching, Self-Portrait Reflection. That is, the dark image of Self-Portrait Reflection possesses some profound sense of sadness is clear. However, what is not so clear is the level of effort, of honesty, even of love, the print must have represented to its maker. The artist's face presents us with both a biological and a psychological truth. As in other images, Freud's physical manipulation of the etched lines results in a figure as much carved as it is etched. Freud looks at his reflection with the same relentless scrutiny with which he looks at everything else in the world. His need for psychological acuity in all his etchings drives his placement of his likeness within a background of short, charged marks. It is a shower of etched lines that looks not unlike metal filings pushed and pulled in a magnetic field. The intensity of this charged field of etched marks surrounding his pensive, downcast gaze is undeniably unsettling and suggestive of the deepest concerns Freud has as an artist and human being at this stage in his life. The quietly articulated image has the dark resonance of great art and penetrates to the very heart of Freud's portraiture. The paradoxical nature of the human condition is laid before us with all the intensity his imagination can bring forth. His self-depiction shows us a stooped old man looking forth alone into the vastness of the world with, if not dread, then something frightfully close. The etching has no sentimentality, no hidden agenda of social or political import. The artist's eyes look inward as well as out toward the viewer. In an interview with Robert Hughes, Freud offered these words, I'm only interested in painting the actual person and doing a painting of them, not in using them to some ulterior end of art. For me, to use something doing something not native to them would be wrong. As in Rembrandt's last etchings of himself, we are made to see the face as the best indicator of a person's character and disposition. The expressive quality of the etched lines in this self-portrait immediately makes us poignantly aware of the temporal and transitory nature of life beyond mere appearances. That etching that I'm talking about is not in this show, but I'm going to show it to you. It's much darker than it's been reproduced. And the whole etching is just charged, like it's been plugged into an electrical outlet. And I think that's the case with, let's talk about these etchings real quick and then I'll let you folks go. We don't have very many here. He was a prolific maker of prints. There is no self-portrait of him here. I'm not sure what this one is over here. No. Oh, yeah. Let me just talk about one of these etchings over here real quick. There are four kinds of intaglio prints, four kinds that can be done. Aquatint, engraving, etching, and dry point. Freud only uses two of the four. He kind of uses a little bit of a sense of aquatint by using what's called plate tone. The background of this figure, if there weren't ink on that raw plate, then that would look like that white piece of paper right there. So this is called what's called plate tone. It's simply what happens when you ink a bare plate and you wipe it, there's a residue on there. Also, this chaotic marking on here. Here he actually probably did it because it follows the profile right there. But he's also allowing that kind of stuff to occur too, which I just call static. It means that the plate has been handled roughly. It might even be that he's buying copper. Copper comes in many different, there's mirror copper for gravures. There's copper that's been handled badly. You can take Picasso with the great etching series that Picasso did of Maria Therese. He did something like 22 images on one plate and kept scraping it completely off and putting a new image on it. So he scraped one plate 22 times. So you could scrape a plate clean, but he's allowing this stuff to happen because I think this is exactly, that's some of that spikiness that we saw earlier, some of that sort of Northern European brittleness. Here in Pluto, we really see the spikiness. Pluto has an aura of what looks like an acrylic rug. And again, it just enlivens the image. It takes it someplace else. This is about as close to the etching of Freud that I was talking about. This has a mixture of etched lines, and they're very deeply etched. An etched line means that this plate has been coated with an asphaltum, then with a stylus it's been bitten into, and then it's been put into the acid. If you put it into the acid for a very long time, and it's a good acid, it eats a very deep line, which then when it's inked before it's wiped, is a very dark, deep line. These are all, most of these lines on here are of that kind. What he does do then with dry point means he's coming back in with some kind of a steel-pointed needle. He's then just etching into the, just going right into the copper plate as opposed to etching it. When you dry point, and you actually see, this is beautiful dry pointing, and dry point usually gets very, very dark and very, very feathery and very, very soft. And the reason is that as you drag that stylus through the copper, you're not removing the copper like the acid does. You're actually pushing it up on one side like a little wave. If you could look at it, you would see if you could look at it straight on, you'd see where you gouged down, and then you would see a piece of that copper pushed up. What happens is that piece of copper that's been pushed up catches ink as well. And so it's just a feathery line because there's ink, and not only in the groove, but there's ink caught inside of it. And also, all these paint, well, there's a great amount of dry point down in here. And a lot of places where he goes back in and he kind of darkens things, it's kind of hard to say. And then plate tone acts as this kind of aquatint. Aquatint would be a solid area, and he likes solid areas, but he doesn't really want to use aquatint. So he's just letting plate tone kind of place this world back in there. On this one, actually, he actually colors. It's actually a colored piece of paper. He doesn't really use colored paper. This has got a lot of dry point up in here in places. You know, I should probably just let you folks go. I'm going to show you. You know, he also did some really nice etchings of garden flowers and things that are quite nice. Very, very spiky. Very complex. You know, a lot of people, he really took to etching. He really, really liked it. And I think it's because it gives him this same kind of mark, just like the brush gives him a mark. Jackson Pollock, for instance, hated etching. He did a few, but he much preferred silk screens, things like that. He felt it was too resistant. But I actually think, this takes a long time to do this too. This is something that you have to have a lot of energy to do. This is about as big a copper plate as you would want to etch. That kind of determines the size. Of course, with the paintings, he can go any size that he wants. And the subject matter in the etchings is very much kind of reduced to just usually heads. You don't get these elaborate, like the painting at the other end of the room there is quite elaborate. There's an awful lot going on with it. I did like this funny, I think this is a very funny Freud right here. Because in a way, it's a whole lot like a late Rembrandt in a way when I was looking at it. Where Rembrandt's, by doing these portraits through his life, he's actually letting us see him age as he's getting older and older. And often Rembrandt's wearing, you know, robes and stuff, and there's a very kind of golden light coming down. This is a very big painting, too. So it's interesting how he's just, you know, it just takes a lot of pleasure in doing this stuff. I mean, this whole white thing in here, the textures and the way that he loves to do them. But the face is absolutely ravaged by who knows what, you know. So let's look at the very last painting in here, and then I'll leave you folks alone. This is such a beautiful room again. Here's these nudes laying on these beds, every image in here. This is a very funny painting too, with the figure under the bed. You know, I have to think that's a bit of a sense of humor. I'm not sure. But again, you know, this man looks dead to me. He doesn't look like he's asleep or he's resting, really. I mean, he actually looks like he's dead. And the dog, even with the mouth pulled back and the teeth showing and so forth. You know, this is a very touching. You know, they're like lovers. Very touching. And then there's this. What is that? I don't know. Probably somebody has an idea, you know. But let's look at this very last painting. There's some interesting. This is an interesting room too. You know, and this is a good one to look at. He's still painting things that are not the face in a very simple way, which is what he was doing 50, 60 years ago. This blue scarf, the gray of the suit. Well, you know, but it didn't take him 30 minutes to paint that. But this looks, actually up here, it looks like he got into some kind of trouble. Like he couldn't figure out what he was doing right there. This is very unusual to see an area of a Freud painting that just seems kind of unreconciled. And I'm sure he would hate for me to say that. Let's look at this one around the corner, which is just absolutely. I'm guessing all of you have seen this painting. I don't know. Michael? This has the feeling of a painting that was on the easel when he died. Was it? Yeah. I mean, there's almost one for everybody. There's in MoMA, there's a beautiful Mondrian painting that still has the tape all over it. You know, it's just not finished. Gosh, that just makes it all the more poignant. I mean, this is it. This is what he came to. And this is just a remarkable painting. I think at this point in his life, he's still really curious about paint, just as a painter. He's curious about, I mean, here's the dog, which shows up over and over again as a symbol of a lot of things, you know, fidelity, affection, companionship. This person is much more kind of, this person's sort of crouching, a different kind of look than we've seen earlier. And yet the backgrounds still have a lot of this sort of, I would say, flow, which the etchings have a lot of flow. But this is an amazing surface. I don't know how he got that. But I can, my sense is by looking at this, that he's after something really beyond surfaces. I mean, behind all that kind of world we call as the real world. he's trying to go underneath the real world. And I think he's always tried to do that. It would have been interesting to see what, and there's no way to know. This might not have looked like this at all had he lived another couple of years and finished it. There's no way to know. But it's very interesting to look at it now. I mean, this background where we've seen a lot of very plain backgrounds before is very chaotic, almost like torn parts of the world are back behind there. I don't know what all this little stuff down in here is. Could be these just, sometimes painters will just touch their brush to see something real quick, you know, and they're going to get rid of it later. I think this is opposite this another self-portrait. This self-portrait reminds me of the etching that I was talking about. Very dense. Still has that Northern European light. Still has that spikiness. Still has Hans Memling. Still has Damascena's Palermo Annunciation. I mean, it's all still there. You know, just the person alone. You know, just at the. And all that means. And it's funny that Clement Greenberg said the one thing you can't do is paint a portrait. I just can't help but think of that stupidity when you look at something like this. And the background, his head just kind of dissolves into that background. You know, he's kind of coming out of it. He's sort of emerging from paint and then falling back into it as well. It's one of his hands up there like that. That's a very touching gesture, I think, to put one's hand like that. I mean, it's kind of what we do. It's just, you know, that's the heart, basically. And again, though, you know, the suit is completely smooth. This is, I mean, he's in the background. He's just energy. He's just almost sheer, and he's just atoms at this point. Gorgeous. Well, thank you for bearing with me. I talked way over. But it's really a pleasure. Thank you. Now, I'm happy to answer any questions if you feel like it. I'll stay as long as you like, yeah.
Yeah. Is it known what his view was of things like abstract expressionism?
I'm not going to stand here and tell you I know that much about all, you know, his opinions and so forth. He was a very opinionated man. I know that. And I'm sure that he... My understanding of most artists is that they sort of understand it's a big world, you know. And that, I mean, to me, this reminds me a lot of Jackson Pollock. I can't look at that and not think of, you know, the sheer love of paint, the surface. I think he had to have it. Yeah.
I'm intrigued by the increasing impasto as he ages as to whether that is compensation for his inadequacies and his prowess as individual brushstrokes associated. His age to achieve the same
dynamism
in the skin, or whether it's purposeful. And I've not seen that addressed in any of the interviews.
You have heard him answer it?
No. I noticed that, but I'm wondering, is this a physical inadequacy, or is it done on purpose?
Well, you know, they say El Grecos are all wacky because of his eyes. I have to think that the man, I mean, look what he's able to do in this one painting. I mean, I have to think he's doing what he wants to do. I mean, I don't see any loss of... I see that he's... you know, he doesn't even have a shirt on underneath this jacket. He has a scarf. That's another very vulnerable way. I mean, I don't know if you ever walked around with a scarf on your neck and a jacket with no clothes. I mean, it's a very kind of a strange, touching kind of thing to do. And he's actually maybe tugging on that knot right there. I'm not sure what he's doing right there. No, I think he's doing what he wanted to do. I think he's just running out of time, running out of energy. You know, studio is, by this point, his studio, he can barely maneuver in it. And he could have gotten a bigger studio. He could have afforded anything. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to make a comment about the picture. At the time when he made that comment, it was valid, considered valid at that time.
Point of
that. And then, like,
well, I think I'm just saying, I think you got to be careful what you say, because if you live long enough,
yeah, that's
You can be made a fool. No, he was a very interesting man. And I'm one that I very much think there's multiple ways of looking at work, talking about work, thinking about work. Yeah.
The paintings where he has two people and you can't figure out why they're there yet.
Uh-huh.
Could that be a portrait of one person at different times in their life?
I don't think they are. I think those are all. He wouldn't do that. That's sort of tricky. He's not a very tricky person. I think he's painting individuals. I don't think he's doing. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he has. I'm not really aware of it. I don't think he's doing that. I think he's got his hands full with the here and now. He's not trying to be that too inventive, really.
You said that's the last painting.
Yes. Unfinished on the easel.
So that's like, do you think it's unfinished?
Definitely unfinished.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen a lot of them. Every artist has an unfinished painting. They all look like that. Most of them.
But that's not intentionally
there. He just hasn't finished it.
So you just pile a bunch of paint on top of there, you're going to file it down or peel it?
Off. Well, who knows what he's going to do, but I mean, he's concentrating. The one thing it does show you is that the figure is the important thing for him, because that's what he's spending all the time on. And then he goes to the dog. So there's a hierarchy of importance. I mean, you can see it in all the paintings. I just don't think that this suit matters as much to him as a thing to paint as this does. Even here, there's areas that are very, you know, here's that same gray coming up here.
By the way,
mm-hmm.
I just noticed that I think you could reproduce his studio just by going around the different paintings, you know, and piecing them together. Because you mentioned the wall, that same wall appears in two or three of
studios. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he really likes the familiarity of certain things and stays with them a lot. Hey, how are you?
Good to see you.
Thank you for coming.
I think he does a kind of a collage. He puts people in front of objects and windows.
Well, objects are...
This looks good.
Objects have always been kind of metaphors for other things. You know, it goes way back. You know, the woman holding the roses in the front there, it's not an accident.
But, you know, like the mortar and pestle.
Yes, yes.
Needed
yeah,
something
yeah.
there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
So he pushed
yeah.
this over. And
yeah, yeah. Well, it's often said that paint, I've heard people say about painters, you know, they just like to paint. So their subject matter and everything they do is just a way to set that up. Because what they really like to do is play with paint, work with paint.
Yeah.
You know, love to mess with paint.
I think he just liked doing what he did. And once he's finished.
Oh, sure.
They just...
Yeah, I'm sure he more than liked it. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Yes.
I've noted that some of the things you mentioned look like there's surrealism that he puts in out here itself. It's melting into the background.
Uh-huh.
It's surrealistic more than, you know, he may not acknowledge it. He may never have acknowledged it. But to me, you mentioned Jackson Pollock, but I see more surrealistic view of melting. And then some of the things you mentioned about the changed dimensions that you could only achieve by painting and cannot achieve by photography. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that not surrealism also? Changing dimensions?
Well, you could. You know, to me, I mean, surrealism is just another word among many.
Wow.
I mean, there may be a word that best describes it that I don't even know what it is. The word exists in French or something. But no, those are valid observations. I have no idea. I don't think he was much for surrealism. I think he liked realism. And I think in this case, you know, that this is very real to him.
Okay.
Very real to
One
him.
One other observation. You mentioned, and indeed, there's a disparity between some of the objects, like the one where the lady and the big fat woman
mm-hmm.
in the front,
mm-hmm.
and you have the dog over here,
mm-hmm.
and you have another person.
Mm-hmm.
Three separate pictures, sort of all in one,
mm-hmm.
but they don't belong together.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned another one where she really was the grandmother, the mother, rather, I guess,
mm-hmm.
was in the front, looking on her own direction,
sure.
the other one in the back.
Yeah.
The proportion is not accurate. I mean, not...
I mean, I think he could do that, but I think he's amplifying the alienation.
Yes.
I mean, I think that
yes.
he's showing there's the ocean between people that are even.
I think he's showing several things, but
yeah.
also I think he's showing how dimensions are. You know, we sort of think always in terms of just how dimensions we see in reality.
Sure.
But in the mind, we, you know, he's after all the grandson. You know, I raised him. You know, yeah. When I analyze it, it's up to me to
Anyway, that's kind of what I'm talking about. Well, thank you for coming.
Okay. Thank you.